Good morning. Please be seated.
There's a light in here.
Our first case is People of the State of Colorado versus Jody Carbajal. And case number 2012-235. Are both parties ready? Ready? Can you hear me out there? No. Yes or no? Can you hear me? Okay. Thank you. Argument is set for an hour, half an hour aside. The petitioner will have to keep track of your time. And when you make your argument, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And lastly, I want to tell the audience, as well as the lawyers, that we use iPads. We have all our briefs on the iPad. We have our notes on the iPad. And we also have our links to legal research on the iPad. So we're not surfing and using the internet. Thank you.
I don't think that's on.
Good morning. My name is John Seidel. I represent the prosecution of the People of the State. Bar number is 1763. I have to say that the last time I was on high school stage like this, it was almost 35 years ago. But it was an honor just like this now. The Court of Appeals has been reading stock instruction on the Popo defense in a way that renders.
Could you just explain what the Popo offense is for the benefit of the audience?
Sure.
Thank you.
Right now it's codified in section 18-12-108 of our criminal code. Basically says that a person who's been convicted of a felony may not possess a deadly weapon or a firearm. Now, section 13 provides that the right of no citizen, no person to keep and bear arms in defense of home, his own personal property shall be called into question. So they have a little conundrum here. We're between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, the Constitution says to keep and bear arms in defense of home, personal property, but the Popo statute says felons may not.
Well, these are felons who have served their entire sentence that we're talking about today, or not?
Well, it's one having been convicted of a felony, so they could have served the sentence, or they may be on parole, which is still a part of their sentence. But in either case, the statute of Popo, when I say Popo, I mean possession of a weapon by a previous offender. The first letter of those words tonight.
Well, but my point is that once you're a felon, you're always a felon, even though you've completed your entire sentence, including mandatory parole.
Under this statute, yes. Okay. So it doesn't draw distinctions between those who are completed or not completed in the sentence. Now, the way the Court of Appeals is the reading Popo and the affirmative defense, a felon cannot be convicted for possessing a firearm with subjective intent to use it to defend against an unspecified threat of an unknown harm at some indefinite time in the future. Well, that makes Popo an empty prohibition for two basic related reasons. In the first place, nobody possesses a gun can deny that it serves their Section 13, and by that I mean Article 2, Section 13 of the Constitution. Our right to bear arms. No one can deny that possessing a gun serves those interests, defense of home, person, or property. This includes felons who are have a gun and currently intended to use it offensively, or simply passively possess it while they're engaged in criminal activity. In fact, their interest in possessing weapons for defense of home, person, and property is arguably greater when they're committing or in the process engaged in nefarious activity. The fact is that when the defendant says, I have this gun to defend against home, person, and property, no juror can rationally say, well, he didn't really have it for that purpose, because that is the whole point of having a deadly weapon like a firearm, is for use to protect oneself. Now, there may be other reasons, but this brings me to the second reason the problem is really not enforceable. The prosecution can never, it can give you all the other reasons, give a jury all the other reasons a felon might have possessed a weapon. It's a drug dealer who was caught in the act of dealing drugs, or maybe he was even caught in the act of using the firearm. The point is that he can still say, under the way the Court of Appeals is deciding these cases, well, I've had the gun for defense of home.
Mr. Seidel, could you, for the benefit of the audience, explain exactly what happened at the trial level, what happened at the Court of Appeals level, and then why it is that you're taking the position you are about the affirmative defense, so that they get a sense of what this case is about? Appreciate it.
This defendant, in 2002, he tried to start a business promoting rap concerts. And he got some trouble from people that were, I guess, in his business already, slashing his tires, breaking his windows, and so forth. So in 2002, he bought a pistol. In 2003, some armed men broke into his town, and they beat his nephew, and they had a gunfight with him, and they shot him in the arm, and then he basically gave up. Went to find the cash that the burglars were looking for, and in the process of that, one of the burglars tried to shoot him with his own gun, and hit point blank in the head. Now, it turns out that his gun was empty, so he lucked out. Well, ever since that incident, he bought more guns, a couple more guns. Now, fast forward to...
And this man was a convicted felon? Is that... And this man was...
At this point, he's not a felon. And he even moved to a new house. He had a security installed. He had a point that we're beginning to... Where this case begins. He had three guns in the home. Now, in March of 2009, he was convicted of a felony of vehicular assault. Sorry, I can't explain much about that crime. Other than say it was a felony on his record, in fact, he stipulated to that in trial. So at trial, in fact, at trial, he stipulated that he was a felon and that he knowingly possessed these weapons. And so really the only issue at trial was he asserted the right to possess these weapons in defense of home, personal property under Section 13 of Article 2.
So he's being prosecuted for possessing a firearm.
Right.
Okay.
Sort of a pass, the defense says passive possession.
So he's not using it, it's not outside the home. The facts are that the weapons are in the home.
Now, in a raid in September 2009, after he was convicted of this illegal assault, police found these weapons. They also charged him with distributing marijuana and accessory to crime. I don't know what the crime was. At any rate, when the case went to trial, this defendant was convicted of counsel, Palco, what happened was he asserted this affirmative defense, meaning the right not to be defense to the crime. And his defense was based strictly on the constitutional language of Section 13. The prosecution said, no, we don't. We think that you have to add some elements to that. We think that the defense ought to be a defendant, a Palco defendant has the, an affirmative defense to Palco only when he has, the defendant has a reasonable belief in the threat of imminent harm. So the trial court agreed to the prosecution and gave that instruction, which differs from the stop instruction in that it contains a reasonable belief and the threat has to be a threat of imminent threat of harm. The Court of Appeals, disagreed with the addition of those two things to the Section 13 stop instruction. And said, no, it's wrong to add those two elements of reasonable belief and imminent harm. And they reversed and remanded for a new trial. As the court knows, we've asked this court to review the Court of Appeals decision. And in fact, other cases have come down against the prosecution with various fact patterns on this issue. And they all seem to believe that the constitutional language is sufficient by itself to authorize an affirmative defense. Whenever a defendant presents any evidence, however incredible or unbelievable it might be, that that's the purpose. He possesses the weapons for the defense of home, person, or property. Well, as I was saying, anybody who owns a weapon can say that. And the prosecution can never really disprove it's subjective. And being subjective, there's no objective evidence to really corroborate that that's the defendant's only purpose. Therefore, the prosecution can never disprove it. Now, it can bring up all kinds of other reasons that the defendant may have had it, including an intent to use it for nefarious purposes, but that doesn't do us any good because the very fact of having a weapon allows a person to say, I have a purpose for property.
Well, could you give us a little background on what imminent means under the state's view of this? I mean, what time period are we talking about? Presumably, the person, if suffering some kind of imminent threat, could get a gun, go buy a gun, protect himself. Now, how does he do that if somebody's coming in through the door? How does he...
That's a good question. And our view of it is... our view is that the choice of evils, statutory affirmative defense, encapsulates the kind of imminence that we're talking about, and also the reasonable belief. And the way it does that, at least as far as imminence goes, is...
Well, let me... Mr. Seidel here. Suppose it's a little hard to figure out who's talking. So let's stay with just look at the basics. So the Court of Appeals said basically, no, you can't put in reasonable belief imminent harm, right? And what is it you want us to say when we write our decision? What do you want us to tell all the trial judges in Colorado to do?
And why do you want us to do it?
And why?
And why do you want us to do it?
Okay, here's what we want.
If you were writing the opinion, what would it say?
You could say, stock instruction, first of all, the Court of Appeals has been saying all along that the affirmative defense is based solely on the constitutional provision, Section 13. This court said in Warren, People versus Warren, all affirmative defenses must be statutory. There are no affirmative defenses that aren't in the statute.
Okay, so like an affirmative defense is when a defendant comes in and says, yeah, what you said I did is true. That is, I am a felon and I do have a gun. But I'm not guilty because of whatever, affirmative defense. Okay, and the affirmative defense that we're worried about now is whether or not this man had a gun, but he had the gun in order to protect himself because he had a reasonable way of imminent harm. So you think that shouldn't be the case? You think there only should be what kind of an affirmative defense, or really just a defense? What kind of a defense are you guys asking for?
Well, what we say is the defense ought to be, and there are many ways of doing, of implementing this, the defense ought to be that the defendant, the Calico defendant, has an affirmative defense to the crime when we have to disprove it, but he alleges that he had possessed the gun out of a reasonable belief in the threat of imminent harm to home, person, or property. Then he has an affirmative defense to the crime. If he produces some evidence to all of those elements, then it's up to the prosecution to disprove those, they can disprove a reasonable belief, they can disprove the fact that there's imminent harm. If we disprove those, he loses and he's convicted, but he can't disprove those, then he has an affirmative defense to the crime and may not be convicted. Now, as I said just a minute ago, all defenses have to be statutory. So we can't really simply add language or make up a defense based on Section 13 and say, well, these are the elements. And that's why we suggested in the briefs that we look at the choice of people's statutory defense and basically use the elements of that defense to encapsulate what we think is necessary, namely a reasonable belief in the threat of imminent harm. And as I said in the brief, the first element of that defense is that the possession, remember, we're going to have to tailor the instructions to this particular crime.
Mr. Seidel, let me interrupt one second. If I'm following where you're going with this and think I did from the briefs, why do we need to tailor that instruction? Why isn't the affirmative defense of choice of evils the only affirmative defense that applies?
I'm not sure that it is. I mean, there may be some cases where other defenses apply, but I think choice of evils actually encompasses many of our other statutory defenses. But I think it is important to realize that, for example, choice of evil says the conduct which is alleged to be criminal has to be necessary as an emergency measure to avoid threatening the imminent public or private injury. Well, what does emergency measure mean? We believe that emergency measure should be defined in the Calco case as when no other lawful alternative is reasonably available to repel the threat of imminent harm.
And is that different from what would be would satisfy the requirements of choice of evils in any other situation?
I'm not sure that in other situations the other conduct has to be lawful. I mean, I haven't really researched that, but I think in many ways that in most situations we would prefer as a society that if you're going to undertake unlawful conduct, there be no other lawful measures. As it stands now, I'm not sure emergency measure has a definition.
I guess where I'm trying to go with this is, if your point is that the constitutional language does not provide a defense, that is, as long as presumably the constitutional limitations are further limited by the reasonable exercise of the police powers of the state, if the previous offender statute is a reasonable exercise, then it's constitutional. I take it, then you're saying the Constitution does not provide a defense to that. But it seems to me where you're going, or if I understand it right logically, is so the only defense to violating that, I mean, you might have another defense if there were one, but it's always a defense that under choice of evils, if you violate a statute because you were faced with a situation that is sufficiently imminent and that we're prepared to recognize as being more evil in the language of the statute than actually complying with the statute. If that's the case, why aren't we just looking at choice of evils, the statutory defense?
Well, I think that's what that's what we would like. That's what we're advocating. All I was trying to say was, you need to make sure the jury's understand what emergency measure means. Here's another example. It says to avoid an imminent public or private injury. Well, the way we see it, most, if not all the cases, the vast majority are going to involve a threat of private injury to person, home, or property. That's really what Section 13 is about. It's not about possessing weapons for public injury. Therefore, the public injury part of the choice of evils might have to be deleted in most cases. But there could be cases for public injury and private injury are both threatened. So in that case, you have to tailor that particular piece of the choice of evils.
Can I ask one other question on that? If the choice of evils statute, if where you're going is that controls, do the preliminary requirements of choice of evils apply as well? Would this have to be presented to the court first, and the court would decide whether the injury, as you put it, either private or public, was sufficient to outweigh the importance or value of the statute before he would decide whether to allow this to go to the jury? Or is this something different from just a defense under choice of evils?
I guess I'm not prepared to say that it should be different. As you suggested earlier, why can't we just look at choice of evils, let it operate the way it operates? I don't see any particular reason to say, well, choice of evils operates this way in most other cases, but doesn't operate that way for common cases. I want to make one point and then try to save some time.
Actually, Mr. Seidel, before you move on, it seems to me from the briefing that your grounding your argument about choice of evils in our statement in blue, that the provision needs to be read in pari materia with the choice of evils defense. But a couple of years later in Ford, we made no reference to that and simply announcing in Ford that a defendant in the situation can assert affirmative defense by simply stating that the purpose for possessing the weapon or using the weapon was in defense of the home, person, or property. So how, in order to arrive at your proposal, would we need to overrule Ford in some way? And if not, why not?
I don't think you need to overrule it. There's only one narrow circumstance in which you would. The reason is that, first of all, although the court didn't say it in Blue or Ford, all statutory defenses have, or all defenses, affirmative defenses, have to be in the statute. Now, to the degree that Ford did say, well, the person who comes up with this evidence has raised an affirmative defense, but remember what the facts of Ford were. Prior to trial, the defendant produced some evidence that he kept the guns for the defense of home, person, or property, for Section 13 of the Constitution. The question that really concerned everybody was, the trial court said, oh, okay, well, then I just missed the charges. And essentially, the defendant said, that's a great thing. I have immunity from prosecution. The prosecution said, no, you don't just miss charges. If anything, the defendant has an affirmative defense which he can assert at trial. At least he has to be, we have to go to trial. And this court said that the prosecution is wrong. You don't get an immunity from prosecution.
Right, it becomes a jury question.
It becomes a jury question, but they also said, the court said it's not a pretrial dismissal. The court said, here's the questions we need to ask. The extent to which Palpolo is limited by Section 13, and what procedures are appropriate for revoking the Constitution. The question for the court and for was only, really, how can we let people assert their Section 13 right in the context of a Palpolo case? And the court said they do it by way of an affirmative defense. The court did not say this is all there is to the affirmative defense. You just recite the constitutional language and the stop instruction. In fact, I think it's significant. The court didn't describe any elements of the defense. All the court did was say there is a defense. And it's significant that the court didn't really discuss Blue at all, because in Blue, the court, as you said, suggested that imminent threat is necessary by referring to the choice of evil defense. Now, I don't want to go too far into my rebuttal time, but I think at this point there's further questions.
Well, I don't think I got an answer to my question, and that is, if we read in this imminent threat, isn't that just tantamount to depriving the person of the constitutional protection? Because imminent threat, I don't know what your definition is, which is basically that the person is invading your property or your home, and you need the weapon for self-defense. So what kind of facts would have to be shown by a person if we endorse this idea that there is no other alternative, choice of evils, it's an emergency, I need to have a gun? We allow them to go out and get a permit before the assault occurs, require them to have a permit? Do they have to put up fences, get guard dogs as an alternative to possessing the weapon? How does this play out?
Well, as I understand your question, the question is really, what happens when to possess a weapon, in the case of a reasonable belief of imminent harm, you have to have the weapon around, basically.
Right, and so
you run out and go to the shop, someone's breaking down your door.
And I think what Justice Hobbs' question is getting at is Palco forbids the conduct from using, carrying, or possessing. And I can understand where imminence might play into use of that weapon or carry of the weapon, but mere possession, I don't know how they could ever just merely possess and also comply with the imminence. How does one actually do that in a way that serves its purpose?
I guess what my position is, it's all right, it's constitutional to limit felons to grabbing the gun that is already pointed at them. Now, other jurisdictions have said this.
Do you mean they have to grab the other guy's gun?
I'm speaking metaphorically.
Well, tell me it wasn't metaphorically. I don't get that at all.
In other words, you can't possess the weapon until you are faced with a threat of imminent harm.
So give us a fact scenario.
This part of it, in this case, there was no threat of imminent harm. He had generalized fear, and perhaps, you know, he was afraid, and rumors that one of the people had attacked him was out of the system. That's not sufficient. You have to wait until your life, your home, your property is being either assaulted or taken.
What does that look like? Be more specific. Do they have to be at the door with their guns drawn?
There has to be, well, if it's in the home, there has to be a break-in, or you have to be able to perceive people about the break-in. Okay? The fact that you think a gang is after you, not enough.
Okay, so
there.
To follow up on Justice Hobbs' question, when they're at the door about to break in, I think Justice Hobbs would then ask you, is that when you're supposed to go out and buy the gun?
Well, obviously that's not practical.
Well, that's our point. So give us a fact situation that is practical.
The fact situation is, in most cases, as you pointed out, the gun will have to be there already. And what we're saying is, you can't be charged. Cannot be convicted. He has an affirmative defense for so long as the threat is imminent, that the people are breaking in. But to the extent that he had the gun prior to the advent of that threat, can be charged. Now you say, well, that's ridiculous because nobody can not possess a gun already and then have it immediately that it would respond to the threat. The response is jurisdiction after jurisdiction after jurisdiction has said that is the price that you pay to be a felon. There's a case, it's not cited before you find it. And I won't even cite it here. I'll just say, look, the Second Amendment, this is not unique. Felons are deprived of the right to vote. They're deprived of certain aspects of their Fifth Amendment privileges. People pay the price for being a felon in many ways. And this, the court has already said, is a reasonable exercise of police power to basically remove from felon the right to possess.
I thought there was a right to vote after you completed your sentence.
Here, there is, but other states, there are not. The Supreme Court has upheld that restriction upheld disenfranchisement of felons in other states. So, Having said that, I've got 2 minutes. I'm going to try to reserve that for rebuttal.
Ms. Seidel, I'm sure you will. I'll give you 2 minutes, but when you get back on rebuttal, you might think about whether or not, under the facts of this case, there was a reasonable belief. And I'd like to hear your response on that, on rebuttal.
Council, students of Arapahoe High School. My name is David Roth. I represent Jody Carvajal. I represented him in the trial court, out the Court of Appeals, and also here today. This is my first time in front of the Supreme Court, so I thank the court for throwing me directly into the fire.
It's a pleasure.
Just one correction in terms of facts. Mr. Carvajal did have a previous felony conviction that actually stemmed back to 1998. The 1998 case, and I believe the conviction entered in 1999, that dealt with a vehicle accident in which he pled guilty to a felony. I guess I want to give some background as to where the defendant comes from in this case and how we get to the position that we take in this case. In People v. Blue, which is this court's case from 1975, this court determined that the then existing possession of a weapon by a previous offender statute was constitutional as a reasonable regulation for the purpose of protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the people of the state of Colorado. In that case, this court also determined that the constitutional floor, that the possession of a weapon by a previous offender statute required, was that you could not abrogate a defendant's right to self-defense or a choice of evil to defense. And I view that statement by the court as saying, because there is a limit to this statute, it's not a flat prohibition in every single case, that was the constitutional floor required, and that is the extent of what the Blue Court did. It was not until a couple of years later in the Ford case that it became necessary for this court to then make a different decision. And that decision was to balance the conflicting rights of the individuals, or in this case of the ex-felons, right to bear arms, and again, the state's interest in protecting its people.
Could you tell us why you think that was necessary to the decision in Ford? Wasn't Ford about immunity versus affirmative defense?
Well, I think Ford, to me, recognized that there is a constitutional provision, and that it did play some role in deciding how far this prohibition can go, how far this statute can go.
I thought, though, you were suggesting that it was necessary in Ford to further refine the relationship between the state and the individual with regard to his rights of self-defense here. Would you care to embellish on that and explain why Ford had to go further than Blue did? I think your opponent was suggesting they were dealing with a different problem and therefore were just making reference to the defense and we're not trying to flesh it out.
And I hope I understand the question, but I think in Blue, in the first case, they make a point to say nobody's raised this issue that they were protecting their home. Nobody's raised this issue that the Constitution applies in this case. So we recognize, and I think that Blue said, this part of Blue initially said, we recognize that's out there, that it may need to be dealt with, but it wasn't raised in this case. In Ford, those defendants did raise that specific issue of saying, we have these weapons. I think it was a husband or a husband who had the prior conviction. The weapons were found in the home. The wife testified in the Ford case saying, my husband possessed these weapons to protect our home, person, and property. And so in Ford, that they did have to deal with it. And while the constitutional floor had been laid previously as self-defense or as choice of evils, this conflict between the Constitution is somewhere above that floor. And so I think Ward, to me, was saying, where is it above this floor? What other right is there?
Do I remember correctly that the primary issue or the reason what was on appeal in Ford was that the judge had dismissed the case by, in effect, granting immunity by ruling on the, by the court before trial that the defendant could not be tried as a result of this provision, and the Supreme Court was saying that was error, you should have let it go to the jury as an affirmative defense, if anything, you couldn't dismiss the case. Was that what the case was about?
I agree.
Okay.
At any rate, so I, at least the defense views, and I view the Ford court then as striking this balance, and that's a balance that was struck 36 years ago, where, as we've just indicated, it allows a defendant to raise an affirmative defense to a possession of a weapon by a previous offender charge when that defendant presents competent evidence that his purpose in possessing the weapon was the defense of his home, person, and property.
Counsel, can I just get to you to stop there? I mean, you're describing, I guess, what Ford actually held, correct? But I didn't say that was the be-all and end-all in this affirmative defense, or is that how you're reading it? In other words, your opponent is saying it simply referenced the affirmative defense. It didn't give further detail, and that's what we're here to look at today, and I wonder what your response is to that.
Well, I agree. I don't think that the court needed to say this is the end-all and be-all to this defense or this decision. But I think that this court struck a balance. And so if you're going to alter that balance, I don't know how you do it without saying that what was done in Ford is incorrect and that therefore Ford needs to be overturned. And this idea, as I can only view the state's position as being that a flat prohibition is what should exist, and that you should strike this balance that was struck by this court before.
But before you totally leave that thought, could I just follow up on it? And then, if you're right about what Ford meant in striking this balance, maybe you could go on and explain to us the implication of your last statement. That is, do you think Ford is correct then, or should we take another look at Ford if that's what Ford said?
Well, I guess number one, I believe Ford is correct. I don't have any reason to doubt this court's opinion.
In terms of the constitutional theory, could you justify that? I mean, how would that work? Is that in effect, the Constitution doesn't on its face provide a defense. It says something that people have a right to do. So does it follow from that you're thinking Ford stood for the proposition that if the statute does not allow a defendant, a convicted felon, to possess a weapon for his own protection, then the statute is unconstitutional to that extent?
I think that there's still an argument to be made along those lines. I think that the statute that we're dealing with today is very different than the statute that was dealt with by the Ford Court. The Ford Court dealt with a statute that was limited. It limited prior convictions to those convictions which involved burglary, arson, or the use of force, or the use of a deadly weapon. And it limited those convictions to 10 years in the past. Mr. Carvajal would have met neither of those conditions. He wouldn't have been charged, period, under the statute as it existed in court. This court's never looked at whether the expansion of that statute is possibly not a reasonable protection of the community.
Just let me follow up on that, just to make sure I understand. I appreciate what you're saying here. Does that equate with saying then that you think our current statute is not a reasonable exercise of the police powers and is therefore unconstitutional?
I certainly think I should have raised that at the trial court.
I'd like to follow through on the implications of that. So just tell us what the current statute provides, the possession statute under which he is prosecuted.
And the statute as it existed in 1977 is a subsection of the current statute, which results in a higher class felony conviction. In this case, Mr. Carbajal's conviction was a class 6 felony conviction, the lowest class of a felony conviction. But under that subsection of the statute, any prior conviction, no matter how old, no matter for what offense, can result.
And this is a lifetime?
A lifetime.
On possessing a weapon?
Correct.
Presumably it's illegal then for a felon the rest of his or her life to go out and buy a gun?
Correct.
Okay.
And I think there's just that in of itself, there's some problems with that. You can reach absurd results. And although a lot of times we talk about absurd results, I think when we talk about absurd results in this situation, they're unfortunately not far-fetched. Mr. Carbajal's conviction could have easily been for use of a Schedule II controlled substance, use of drugs. And if his conviction had been for use of drugs, that offense is actually now being classified as a misdemeanor. So he may have a prior felony conviction for an offense which is now a misdemeanor, which in addition, he could have sealed the records. Because under Colorado law, after a 10-year period, a person in that situation would have the right to go back and seal his records. So arguably, if he went to apply for a job at Walmart, nothing would show up as record. And he could actually tell them, I've never had an incident. I've never been convicted of a felony. None of that's ever happened, except next week I could be on trial for possession of a weapon by a previous offender. And those are the kind of results that this statute now allows us to obtain. But not only that, the state's position is not only should we get to those results, but when we get to them, let's not give that defendant even an affirmative defense that he possessed this weapon for a constitutional purpose.
Counsel, can I just get you to switch gears and tell us what the defense actually looks like in your view? I mean, I presume that you're saying there's an affirmative defense, and I think just judging from your brief, you agree that it's a sort of choice of evils kind of defense, correct?
Well,
And what does that look like?
I guess I'm not sure I do agree with that. I think we get into that discussion that somehow those elements need to be present. And in this case, Mr. Carbajal passively possessed these weapons in his home. And my position is that under this constitutional provision and under his rights afforded him under that section of the Colorado Constitution, that these other issues don't come up, that he can passively possess this weapon in his home with no threat. There doesn't have to be some imminent threat or perceived threat. Mr. Carbajal had a threat that was out there in his particular case.
Is it your position, though, that he nonetheless has to testify that the reason he had the gun was to protect his home?
Certainly, he's got to present competent evidence to give the affirmative.
He can't say he had the gun to go hunting.
Correct.
So he has to come up and say, I had the gun because I might, I don't know when, but there might be a time when I need to defend my own.
Well,
and the jury would have to believe that.
The jury would have to believe that. I mean, the board made clear that the question of the defendant's purpose in keeping the weapon is one for the fact finder. And this idea that fact finders can't somehow figure this out is just not the case. Fact finders figure out these kind of things all the time. It's no different than self-defense when the defendant's claiming that I had a reasonable belief that I was had this threat of harm towards me. So fact finders ferret out these issues. You know, I think the problem in Mr. Carbajal's case and what the state sees is they didn't have any evidence to dispute his affirmative defense. They didn't have evidence to say, well, Mr. Carvajal really wasn't keeping these guns for that purpose, because Mr. Carvajal was out on the streets with these guns every night. And we had evidence that Mr. Carvajal packed this gun when he went to the bar on Saturday night. And we had evidence that Mr. Carvajal was involved in a drive-by 3 weeks ago. Or we had evidence that Mr. Carvajal used a weapon during a robbery. So the state's complaint in this case is that we don't have evidence to dispute Mr. Carvajal's claim about why he possessed these weapons.
Now, let me ask you this. Now, stock instruction paralleled the language of the Constitution. Is that correct?
Yes.
But there isn't a statute doing that.
That's correct.
Well, would you just explain to me then how the state takes the position that there can only be statutory affirmative defenses?
Well, I guess I heard that raised, and I think I did see that that is brought up in the briefs, but I'm not sure I understand or have seen the case law that says an affirmative defense can only be based on a statute. I mean, at some point in the past, I think self-defense was raised before it became a statute by common law or by some other method. But I'm not sure I agree that every affirmative defense somehow has to be tied to a statute. Certainly, the court in Ford didn't agree with that because they said this is based on the Constitution, it's based on the language of the Constitution, and it wasn't worried about it not being tied to some specific statute. So I'm not sure I agree that that's a requirement of
affirmative defense. In Ford, Justice Carrigan said specifically that referred to the constitutional affirmative defense. Specifically, those were his words. So clearly you can have an affirmative defense that is tied to the Constitution.
I would agree with that.
Let me ask you about the concept of reasonableness. And the Attorney General seems to be arguing that, unless we throw in some kind of concept of reasonableness or in addition, he argues imminence, well, then, in fact, we've just obviated the whole purpose of the statute, because anybody could get up and say, I have a gun to protect my home, and that would be that. And so there should be something a little bit more than just that. There should be kind of a showing of, it's reasonable that I have a gun to protect my home because of XYZ, because I've been threatened, or because of whatever. Why isn't maybe that appropriate?
And that, I think, was an issue that was raised in the concurrence at the Court of Appeals. One judge concurred in the decision, but was advocating a reasonableness added to that.
And I'm distinguishing reasonable from imminent now. Let's just talk reasonableness.
I think that it's certainly, for one, it's not precluded already under the language that's there. And that's not, I guess my bottom line would be, that's not the language in the Constitution. And there's no authority or basis to start adding language to the Constitution. But there's nothing to preclude the state from arguing that Mr. Carvajal's argument or Mr. Carvajal's claim is not reasonable. It's not reasonable that Mr. Carvajal's going to say that he possessed these weapons for protection of his home, because we know that he did X, Y, or Z. Again, this case, the state's problem is they didn't have those facts.
And I'm interrupting you, but if I may do so. So what would it look like? How would it be different at the trial level if the judge said to the jury, that we have this affirmative defense, and the defense is that the defendant is going to say that he was trying to defend his home, versus if the judge said, the defense is that the defendant is going to say that he was reasonably trying to defend his home. How would that even be different factually?
I guess I don't think it is factually different. I think it could still be argued, but I'm certainly not conceding that reasonable should be included in the statute.
Okay, and I take it you would very much object to the whole concept of imminent. They had an imminent belief.
Yes.
Can you tell me why, please?
Well, the main reason is because it falls outside of this constitutional language, but I think as this court has talked about today, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, you're gutting that constitutional provision. If that's what you're going to do, gut Ford and gut that constitutional provision, then put imminent in there, because when Mr. Carbajal's in his home and the threat comes to the door, he can't run out and get his weapon. He can't run out and go to the store, get through the background check, and get his weapon and run back in and say, okay, now I'm ready to protect my home. So it basically gets rid of that defense in any fashion or form. And I think the other problem with that is it basically says, I'm going to give more rights to the person on the street, to the ex-felon on the street with a weapon who gets in a shootout, because he's got a claim of self-defense. And I guess if we don't know he possessed this weapon 1 minute or 10 minutes before this shootout occurs, then he's got a better defense, because he's going to be able to raise self-defense than the person who passively possesses this weapon in their home for protection of their home. And I'm not sure, this is not the facts of our case. I'm not sure that the statute or the affirmative defense, and I think that the Attorney General alluded to it, that there may be other restrictions. I mean, the constitutional provision itself indicates that the right of no person to keep and bear arms in defense of his home, person, and property, or in aid of the civil power when thereto legally summoned shall be called into question. And goes on to indicate that this does not allow for carrying of a concealed weapon. And so arguably, I'm not sure you would get the affirmative defense if you're out on the street carrying a concealed weapon. But that's not the facts of our case. Our case is a passive possession within his own home.
Can you just elaborate on the facts and what actually was testified to?
The facts of the case are there was an unrelated case, which actually was a murder that took place in Pueblo County. And somebody along the line in that murder case had said that one of the suspects had brought a safe to Mr. Carbajal's house, and with the idea of trying to open this safe. And that was never shown to be true or never shown to be correct or proven, but that was enough to where a search warrant issued for Mr. Carbajal's house. And in the process, the police then came looking for this safe or looking for the contents of this safe, of which they found neither, but in the process, they uncovered these guns that weren't in Mr. Carbajal's possession or on his person at the time of the search warrant. They were in his home at different locations.
Well, what are the facts of what he showed with regard to any type of threat that would have justified?
I think, again, as the Attorney General had talked about, he had been in this music business and he had been subject to a home invasion where he had actually been shot in his own home. And he and one of these individuals was actually being paroled fairly quickly. In the time frames that we're talking about. So these weapons were in his home. Mr. Carbajal testified in this case and testified that he had a fear that these individuals who had gone to prison would be released and would come after him. And he had a generalized fear. He had presented some medical testimony that he had post-traumatic stress disorder from this previous incident in his home. And so he protected his home. But again, I'm not so sure that we have to show some potential or imminent or any kind of threat.
Speaking of imminence, was then, during closing arguments, was the fight around the imminence of that threat?
As I recall, I think the fight was mainly around imminence, because at that point in time, the court, over our objection, had said, we're going to give a jury instruction. And now, defense, you have to show that the threat was imminent. And I think as the Court of Appeals said, basically,
well,
it should have been the
actually, wasn't it the prosecution's burden to disprove the imminence?
Well, I'm not sure how you disprove that it wasn't, that it was drawn or it wasn't. I guess, again, unless they're standing at your door, I think that's the argument. One of the problems is what does imminent mean, but I think what imminent means to people is unless they're breaking down your door at the moment, you're not imminent. So you can't possess the weapon. So again, I think it just basically defeats the entire constitutional provision and the entire defense as set out before.
So let me ask just one last question. Under, if we were to strip away any additional requirement that it be reasonable and or imminent, your opposing counsel suggests, well, what you've essentially done is created an affirmative defense, if you will, that's absolutely coextensive with an ordinary person's right under the Constitution. And as a result, PALPO doesn't in fact restrict a convict's rights in any meaningful way. What is your response to that?
Well, I think if you're an ex-felon and if you are passively possessing a weapon in your home and your purpose is to protect your home and there's no indication of any other purpose, then your right is not too far off of that right that a non-ex-felon would have. But I think, keep in mind, you know, there's a common misunderstanding among prosecutors that being charged with a crime somehow is not a problem. This is an affirmative defense. Mr. Carvajal, as other ex-felons, would likely be arrested, put in jail, charged with a crime, required to either post bail or remain in jail until his trial, and then he's allowed to raise an affirmative defense, which he needs to convince a jury would apply to. So it's not the same right. It's not anywhere close to the same right as what an ordinary person would have. An ordinary person who was subject to that same search warrant would have been said, you know, hey, sorry, we didn't see anything in here. Those are your weapons, and have a good night.
And so the limiting factor is that this defendant would at least at a minimum need to show that his purpose in possessing, carrying, or using the weapons was in defense of home, property, or person. Whereas a non-former convict wouldn't have to prove anything. I had a weapon, I was entitled to have a weapon. In other words, an ordinary person wouldn't have to prove his purpose for having a weapon.
Right, an ordinary person would never be subject to the prosecution.
Okay, thank you.
And so what you're saying is that's a balance between the public purpose of trying to keep out guns from felons who can use them, let's say outside the home. I mean, there's a legitimate purpose there. So in a way, you're arguing that the fact that you have, that you're restricted to raising an affirmative defense really does put a burden on you with respect to showing that you're entitled to this protection of the Constitution. This, for this narrow purpose, let's say it's a narrow purpose of defense of property and home. I assume that your argument might be, if the people want to change the Constitution, they can prohibit ex-felons from having any weapon under any circumstances. But that's not what the Constitution provision says, right?
According to this court, I agree with that, Justice.
So how long have we had this provision in the Constitution?
1876.
Thank you, Justice.
It's in the original Constitution. It's been there forever.
So what would happen if a felon was carrying a gun outside of the home? Obviously, your position is there would not be an affirmative defense.
That probably wouldn't be my position at the trial court. But I have to argue, and I don't think, those facts are not the facts. That's not our case today. I think there is some concerning language that somebody would have to deal with if that were your claim. And I think,
I don't know why you're not conceding that for the purposes of this argument.
They told me not to concede anything. I guess what I leave you with is, you know, I think but the statute has changed significantly, and I think that's an important point that should not be overlooked by this court. And I think when Ford, under the original statute, looked at this, what they said was, the purpose was to limit the possession of firearms by those who, by their past conduct, have demonstrated an unfitness to be entrusted with such dangerous instrumentalities. Not sure that every felony conviction, no matter how far in the past, still meets that purpose. And I think that's an issue that needs to be resolved before we try to limit any affirmative defense.
Thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Seidel.
Was the threat here imminent? No, it was not.
No, that wasn't my question. My question was the threat reasonable?
Well,
and how do you
what
do
I'm
that?
Saying is there was no reasonable belief in the threat of imminent harm. One of the things the other person pointed out was that that question is figure out the defendant's real purpose. Well, our position is they have no objective way of doing it. Let's take this case. This defendant was, there was evidence, I guess, during the seizure, or during the search, that he was distributing marijuana, and that he was, at least they thought at the time, an accessory to the crime. So here we have a person who is evidently engaged in some kind of nefarious activity, but yet he claimed at trial that he wanted to possess a weapon for the defense of all personal property, and he was acquitted on one count of power. The jury, you could give all the reasons, the bad reasons, why a felon would want to possess a weapon. The point is, as long as you can say that defense of all personal property is one of those reasons, the jury has no reason to think that those other reasons have anything to do with it. So this applies to the guy in his home and the guy on the street. There was a question about, well, gee, maybe this version of probable isn't constitutional. Our point is, with the appropriate defense as we have outlined it, it can be, it is constitutional.
And time is up. Chief, if I answer one last question. I'm still wrestling with the imminence part of your argument. If we had a defendant who it was shown had used a weapon in actual self-defense, that person came through the door and I used a weapon that I already had in the home in self-defense, under your view, could that defendant probably could not be convicted for using that weapon under the Palco statute, but could that defendant nonetheless, under your view, still be charged with possession of that weapon, having possessed it prior to the imminence of the intrusion?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think the answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments, and the case will be submitted on the briefs, and we'll take a brief recess, and I appreciate it if you'd answer questions by the students. Thank you.
All right.